Hello, once again, I'm Kelly Elbin on musingsongolf.com. My good buddy and partner, Bob Bupka, is a little bit under the weather this week, so I'm going solo. Hey, by the way, before we get to our guest, invite you to subscribe to Musings on Golf through Apple, Spotify, or whatever your platform may be your favorite. We've got a great guest today on Musings on Golf, but before we get to that guest, have a listen to this old favorite.
Hey, take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team.
The Major League Baseball playoffs are off and running, and I promise you that our guest today is keeping a close eye on one particular team this postseason. He was an integral part of the amazing New York Mets World Series championship team in 1986, and his Metropolitans are trying to continue another improbable run to another title this week. To me, he's my golfing buddy at East Point Country Club in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. To baseball fans, he's the guy known for the Tuffle Shuffle. Tim Tuffle, welcome to Musings on Golf. How are we doing?
I'm doing great, Kelly. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It is that time of year, and it's fun to mix a little bit of baseball and golf. Let's start with baseball first. What happened with the Mets in Game 6 in 1986 is something that is truly part of baseball lore, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But I know you keep close tabs on the current Mets. You've been an ambassador for the club. It has to have been a lot of fun to see some of these crazy wins of late. And as we speak, midday on Tuesday, October 8th, they're headed into Game 3 of the best of five against the Phillies, going back to Citi Field. What do you think?
Well, they've had some extraordinary come-from-behind wins. They've continued to show a lot of resilience, for sure. Lindor put them in the playoffs. You know, they were down a run, and he hits a two-run homer late in the game, catapults them into the series. And then, you know, Pete Alonso has a dramatic three-run homer in the ninth inning, down by two runs to also put them in this position. So they've had a lot of drama. It reminds me a lot of the 1986 team. They had about, I think they said they had 44 come from behind wins, and that was what really our team makeup was very similar to that. We've had a good bullpen, so they kind of kept us in games. They kept us around the one or two run mark where we didn't fall too far behind. That was allowing our offense to come from behind and be dramatic. So I see a lot of similarities between this team and the 1986 team. And, you know, when you're talking about playoffs, short series, anything could happen. And when the ball starts bouncing your way, you kind of feel it as a team. And I think that's what the Mets have been feeling for the last month and a half of the season. You know, they started off very slow this year, as you know. They were 13 games under 500.
Right. Yeah.
And
they hardly were thinking about playoffs at that point, for goodness sakes.
Oh, they were thinking about survival. You know, we're looking at it. Are they going to be, you know, sellers, or are they going to be buyers at the trade deadline even?
Yeah.
You know, with that being said, they just took off, and they've been playing great baseball ever since.
Hey, Tim, take our listeners sort of into the mindset, whether from your days playing or now watching. What's it like getting caught up in that wave of momentum, the best possible? Is it really a just a simple belief that we're going to find a way to win? We're not going to lose. Somehow, some way, we're going to win.
And that's kind of what it was. It's kind of those feelings where you see the ball bounce your way, or you go into the ninth inning, say, and they walk the leadoff man, and you go, oh, here we go. You know, it's those types of things that you have a feel for the game. Like the other night watching the game, I said, they walked the leadoff man. That was before Pete Alonso's three-run homer. And I said, when Pete got up, I said, and he's due. So that here's the tables all set up. You don't walk the leadoff man in the eighth and ninth inning. That's the cardinal rule of pitching. They did so, and next thing you know, the wheels fell off for the opposing team, and we end up winning the game. So you do have feelings, and even being out of the game, being in so many baseball games in my life, you know, you could feel it even as a spectator.
Yeah, and you, there's no question, and you, and I think you can feel it. I don't really have any player in the game, if you will, between the say the Mets and the Phillies, but you can feel it watching it. I could feel it yesterday with Detroit. That the kids at the plate at the bottom of the ninth or top of the ninth, he keeps fouling off a couple, and then he gets a ball right in his wheelhouse and just hammers it. Right.
Yep. And they have that feeling too. I'm telling you, Detroit has come out of nowhere. You know, No one's expected them to be even in this position in the beginning of the year. So they've had one of those magical years. And, you know, we've seen this before. We've seen the Nationals win the World Series just, you know, a handful of years ago where, you know, they weren't even predicted to be even in that division series. So it can happen in a short series. A team gets hot, team gets on a roll, and you're going to ask for a prediction at the end of this. It could be Detroit. It could be the Mets. It's whoever is hot, whoever gets hot in these short series, and you know, and magic has to come their way a little bit. They have to have the breaks.
Let's talk a little bit about the tuple shuffle. Now, as golfers, you know, a lot of us have a little waggle to sort of preset our swing just to get comfortable. Took it in a little different direction with the shimmy shake at the plate. Had you always done that little move with your rear end?
I had a little bit, but I really didn't start doing it until I saw Mike Schmidt take batting practice one day. And Mike Schmidt was a guy who kind of settled into his stance. And so I said, you know what, I'm not driving the ball like I know how to drive the ball. I need to get a little more rhythm. And that's kind of where it happens. And I took it to a new level, I guess. The more comfortable I got with it, the more relaxed I got. And it almost like I was sitting in a rocking chair going back and forth. So it was it's just one of those things that kind of evolved. It worked. It felt comfortable. It relaxed me. And next thing you know, my wife's going, what the heck are you doing up at the plate? And they took a side view of it one time, and that was I'm getting comfortable. So that was my best year, the best year I've ever had.
Well, the Mets faithful loved you for it, right? As long as you were hitting.
As long as you were hitting and producing, you know, that's this game. It's survival of the fittest for sure.
Well, we'll take a little seventh inning stretch right now so we can hear what our partners have to say. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass. Hey, let's talk a little bit of golf. You and I have had a lot of fun playing golf here at East Point, getting to know one another, et cetera. When did you actually start playing golf? And I'm also wondering, just the sheer motion of throwing the baseball, of swinging the bat, how much has that contributed to help translate into playing golf and trying to play it well?
Well, you know, my game is off and on. I can get hot, I can get cold. It's a slot thing for me. If I find the right swing slot, I have a good day. When I don't have the right swing slot, next thing I know, I'm pulling the ball and I'm pushing it. I'm all over the place. I'm a 13 handicap, as you know, and I've been that ever since. I got down to an 11 at one time, but I just can't break that barrier of consistency. And I think baseball my career in baseball was very similar to that, is finding the slot to hitting it as well.
What do you mean by that? What does that mean, the slot? What does that mean?
It's the take back. It's the making sure when you're addressing the ball that you're doing the same thing over and over again. You have a consistency of a swing. I know the pros deal with that all the time, you know, the elite players. For an amateur, when you don't have feel for it, sometimes you end up thinking you're doing something and you overdo it. I call it the amateur swing. We over-exaggerate. We over-correct. If I'm pushing the ball to the right, I'll over-correct it. Next thing you know, I'm pulling the ball. It's just not being taught. You know, I don't have a lot of coaching underneath my belt as far as my golf game goes. But as you know, you've tried to help me a few times. And
I have.
It's very difficult when you don't put a lot of time into it. You know, you have to spend time in your profession. It's not my profession. It's my hobby. So this is why I'm a 13, and I'll probably be a 13 for a long time.
We're so pleased to be joined by my buddy Tim Tuffle, World Series champion, aspiring golfer, here on a playoff baseball edition of Musings on Golf. Okay, so maybe the next question isn't fair then. What's the tougher game to master?
Ooh. Well, I played baseball for my whole life, you know, and baseball was the thing that I enjoyed playing.
Yeah.
I do enjoy playing golf, but I think golf provides a lot more frustration to me than baseball.
Yeah.
Because
right.
The ball is sitting there. And as a baseball player, you're going, I should be able to execute that. It's sitting there. It's like, all right, so yeah. we hit balls off the tee for baseball to prep our game, to get ready for batting practice. And, you know, I got no problem hitting that all day long off the tee. But the golf ball is just sitting there, and I'm taking clubs out that I should be able to square the ball up. And that becomes very difficult to do, as you know. I think with the variables, I would say the hardest thing to do is to hit a baseball.
Huh.
Just because you're relying on the pitcher, you're relying on the strike zone, you're relying on the umpire. There's a lot into that. I think the mental frustration comes from me in golf is that that's all eliminated. All those variables are gone. It's just me and the golf ball.
Yeah.
That provides a lot more frustration. And I think golf has become the most difficult thing to do for me.
Yeah, and it's you, it's the golf ball, and then that's that space between your ears, right? And how you the mental approach and the ebbs and flows of the game, right?
All right, so here we go into the chipping aspect of the game.
Yeah, what's your you struggle immensely with that? Why?
It's the how to. It's the do I feel comfortable? It's the mind game. It's thinking about, you know, don't do this, don't do that. It takes the athleticism out of your game, the chipping aspect. And you end up thinking so hard on it. It's almost like I see it in baseball when pitchers are out there struggling, trying to find it so hard mentally. You can see it on their face. You can see it in their arm motion. They're not relaxed. They're tense. Well, same thing with chipping. It provides a lot of mental anguish. Here we go. I got to go do the worst thing that I could possibly do, and that's chipping. So I got a lesson, believe it or not, at my golf tournament. I host a golf tournament up in Connecticut every year for the last 34 years, and it's a charity event and whatnot. And Michael Breed came up there, and he was a part of it. And I go, Mike, chipping, tell me what. He goes, Tim, you're a baseball player. All I want you to do is think about pulling the ball down the left field line. And I'm like, what? He goes, I want your feet square. I told him, I said, no, I have my feet open. I'm trying to, you know, bounce the hosel and you know, get the lift and all that. He goes, no, I want you to think about pulling the ball down the left field line. And lo and behold, it brought my left hand through a little bit more. And that's what my swing needed at the time. And I've tried it and it seems to work, but it does, it, you know, I'm still like 6 out of 10. I'm not like the pros that can do it at will and take the pin out. I want to hole it. I'm not even close to that. That's your game. That's not my game. But that's the kind of coaching I get. I got so many variables on chipping. It's unbelievable. And I think sometimes hitting coaches are like that too. We try different things and see what works for you.
Yeah, and a lot of that's a visual thing. Like Breed told you, like you're hitting down the left field line. Now you can picture that, right?
Oh, I said that. Yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about. He's trying to
feel it. You can picture it.
He's trying to get me to finish my swing, get through the ball.
Hey, Tim, let me ask you. We hear a lot about you know, some of the great pitchers, the Smoltz and the Glavins of the world during spring training when they weren't starting. They're out playing golf, and obviously they've gone on, particularly John Smoltz, is a heck of a golfer. Wondering, and you and I have sort of talked about this, you didn't really play golf regularly either spring training or in season during your playing days, correct?
Yeah, never. You never know when you were going to play. You know, I wanted, you know, my profession was my energy needed to be up at 7 o'clock at night. You know, you could probably play golf at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning. As you know, that takes a lot out of you. And I didn't want to get in the way of what I was trying to accomplish professionally. So I knew that golf was always going to be a hobby of mine, and it was going to be one of those later on things. The same with skiing. Like I went snow skiing for the first time after I finished my playing career. You know, you just have to put priorities, make them priority. Pitchers can go out. Mulchy can go out. Glavin can go out. You know, Maddox, those guys, those kind of. Frank Biola went out. He played golf because they pitch everyone every 5 days. So they got time in between where they don't have to exert energy or have to play that night. So, you know, those guys are the good golfers. Those guys who put the time in and pitching is a finesse sport. And really it's a controlled, it's very repetitive of what they're trying to do. And golf is similar. So I'm not surprised pitchers are not good golfers. I'll tell you what, Frank Biola can't even hit a baseball, and Bobby Ojeda couldn't hit a baseball, but they can hit a golf ball, and they had good eye-hand coordination towards a golf ball and good chipping skills. So it's a finesse. It both pitching and golf are finesse sports.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. All right, before I ask this next question, Red Sox fans can turn the sound down for the next minute or so. All right, take us back, please. Game 6, 86 World Series at Shea, 2 down, bottom of the ninth. You guys, 2 runs down. There's nobody on. In fact, the Red Sox actually got within a strike of winning the World Series. You're up 3-2 at that point. What was the Mets dugout like at that stage with 2 out, nobody on?
Well, you can only imagine. You know, Davey Johnson had a bottle of Tums down at his section of the bench. And once in a while, he'd pop those things. Well, he was popping them that night. We sat, you know, I was in the dugout at that time, and it was very dim, and there was not any excitement going on. So I remember sitting back on the bench and just kind of playing it out. And so did Davey, and so did Mel Sotomayor, the pitching coach. And we were kind of just hanging out there, and it almost like was the inevitable, you know, at that time.
Right.
That it was going to be over. And that we were going to fall short of our goal. And then, you know, a bloop single, another bloop single by Gary Carter. Kevin Mitchell had a hit. He was down to 2 strikes. Carter was. And then Ray Knight, bloop single. And then here comes Mookie Wilson up. I'm like, are you kidding me? And the ball goes through Buckner's legs. And next thing you know, we're sprinting out to home plate. And jumping on Ray Knight as he scores, and no one can believe what the heck just happened. It was a matter of minutes. You know, you're not talking a long time here. Things like that in baseball happen quickly. So it was a matter of minutes before we were sunk, and then we were alive, and we're going to play another day. it was truly an amazing feat. It was remarkable. It was, you know, 1969s were the amazing Mets, and
yep.
and certainly, you know, we were amazing at that moment in time, and now we're saying the same thing about this current Met team. We're like, wow, how are they doing it? They've been on a shoestring now for a couple weeks, 3 weeks, and they've rallied to make it happen. So it's very exciting when those things happen. It's monumental when you're on the other side of the success, and it's very traumatic when you're on the losing side, as we watch the Boston Red Sox kind of have all their dreams dismantled within 5 minutes.
Hey, you mentioned Gary Carter. Boy, what a terrific guy he was. You had some really big personalities, really big on that team, right? With Doc
huge,
Gooden.
Huge personality.
Daryl Strawberry. You had Lenny Dykstra. You had Hernandez at first. Now, you had come over in a trade from the Twins, right?
Correct. Yep.
What was that like just fitting in with some big-time egos, big-time personalities, but guys who clearly could play the game well?
Well, that's a team that was made to win. You know, I'm a piece of that puzzle. Frank Cashin obviously brought me over there because they had a tough time at that time beating the St. Louis Cardinals, who was predominantly a left-handed pitching staff. And yep. Pittsburgh got lefties as well. So our division at the time, there was no wild card, and you had to win a division, you had to beat the Cardinals. And they had a left-handed bullpen, they had a John Tudor, they had a variety of left-handed pitchers that kept the Mets at bay. And even though we had 90 plus wins the year before, it wasn't enough to win the division. So we would have made the wild card in today's game, but to beat the Cardinals, I had it was Howard Johnson came over, Kevin Mitchell got brought up from the minor leagues. So we had some right-handed bats now to combat, and to get traded over to a team that had the studs already. They had the Hernandez, yeah. Carter, Mookie Wilson. You know, you had a very good lineup that was deep that fell short. So why did they fall short? It wasn't predominantly for pitching sake. It was basically we had to beat the left-handed lineups that were currently in the division. So that's why I was brought over. And when I came into spring training, I went, holy mackerel, look at these guys. I mean, these guys can play. So there was excitement right from the beginning of the year. There was a lot of expectation from the beginning. We brought Bobby Ojeda over from the Red Sox, and that solidified a pitching staff that was pretty good at the time with Ron Darling and Doc and Sid Fernandez, and Rick Aguilera was in the back end at the time. So there was already enough equipment there and enough talent to really take that division, but there was pieces that needed to be put in place, and that's why I was brought over.
And you grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, so that must have been a cool thing to sort of come back home in a way, right?
No doubt about it. It was like, ooh, when I heard I got traded to New York, I said, which one? And I knew it wasn't the Yankees because Willie Randolph was there. I said, nah, I'm not there. But the Mets was a team to be reckoned with in the National League, and being back home was awesome for my dad. You know, he still lived up there, and I brought my mom and dad down. He saw more baseball games than ever, and that's a rarity in itself. You know, to be in your home. I'm only 35 minutes away from at the time Shea Stadium. So
yeah,
it was a perfect place to go come back to.
Joined by Tim Tuffel here on a special baseball edition of Musings on Golf. Okay, who's the toughest pitcher or pitchers you faced and why?
Well, Lee Smith was a tough pitcher for relief. He was with the Cardinals at the time. He looked like he was letting go of the ball right out of his hand in the batter's box. He was a big dude. He threw hard. He had a good slider. But the toughest pitcher of all time is Dave Steep, and that's from the Toronto Blue Jays. And
yeah.
His name is up on the stadium for a reason. He was a nasty right-hander against right-handers, and if you got a hit against him, it was like going 4 for 4. It was he was a hard thrower. His ball moved up and in to righties, and he had a hell-bent slider. It started behind you and broke late, and it was tough to stay in there on him. And plus, he worked fast, and He was a tough competitor, and he didn't care if he hit you or whatever. And he just had a great mound presence. He was like a Bob Gibson type mound presence.
Mm. Yeah,
you know, he just was he was just nasty. So yeah, he was my toughest pitcher, I think.
Hey, a few golf questions before we close out and get your prediction on a World Series winner, if you will. Do you follow? Mate, you follow the tour. Do you have a favorite player on tour? Is there somebody who you're like, oh, I love that guy, I got to follow him, what have you?
Well, I'll tell you, I do have, you know, Scottie Scheffler is unbelievable. His demeanor and all that is unbelievable. He's got a golf swing I can't emulate. That back foot sliding out and all that. Yeah. I don't know how the heck he does it. He's as we call, a freak in baseball, where, you know, they do things that no one else can do. You know, so I like watching him play. What happened in one of the golf tournaments, and I'll tell you, in Homa, I think that's how you pronounce it, H-O-M-A.
Max Homa.
Yep. He was walking up the fairway, and I believe it was the Genesis out there in California, and he had the headset on, and he was doing an interview during a live match.
That's right.
And I remember that because I said, that is so cool for us to get an inside on a golfer who's in the heat of the battle, walking up. And I'll never forget that, because it brought me into the game and into his realm for the first time, that I felt like I was a part of being an athlete with a golfer. You know, usually you don't get to hear that from a golfer's standpoint. Baseball's doing it. You know, interviews in the dugout and getting the perspective of the player and all that. And I think that's the coolest thing. So I always pull for Max, because he was the guy who first brought me into the golf, inside of the golf world thinking during a match, which was pretty cool. So
yeah, I agree. Again,
I pull for him that he took the time to let the fans know.
Yeah, I agree with you. The production level for so many golf events now is so good. And to be able to have that one-on-one, that inside, that insight, it's pretty darn cool, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, it's very cool. Even for that.
You think you could have done that if playing second base during a game?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, I could have done that. I mean, once the batter is ready to swing, then I would have to shut up and concentrate. But yeah, I think I could have had a mic on and gave some insight out to the game while the game's going on. That might have been pretty cool, actually. To be able to do something like that, you know, give the fans a little something to think about.
Absolutely. Final question for me. Actually, final golf question. I enjoy asking to all of our guests, and we've really gotten some fascinating responses. And it's, if you could play a dream round of golf with three others, whether they're living or deceased, who would those three be to join you? And where would you play that sort of magical full round of golf?
Ugh. Easy on Augusta. I would love to walk in between those gates just to check it out. I tell you, I was the manager in the Sally League, and we played Augusta. We played Augusta, the team from Augusta. And so our bus drove by Augusta that, and I'm like, man, I can't even peek in, you can't see nothing.
I don't know,
it was such a tease. So that's an easy question. Where I'd like to play, who I'd like to play with, that, you know, of course, you know, Tiger, I would like to play with him. You know, I think everybody would like to you know, play with Tiger and just get, you know, just to be with him in his presence, because he is going to be one of the greatest golfers ever. Then of course Arnold Palmer, I would have loved to play with Arnold. But I would like to only play with Arnold, with Arnold's army walking behind him. Because
that would be cool, right?
That would be very cool. You know, I'm shouting and going crazy. And then to bring a little life to the atmosphere, I think I would do Lee Trevino. You know, he would bring a little color to the atmosphere, you know. He would be jawing it up. He would bring probably the best out of Tiger. You know, get him out of his shell a little bit. And then back when I was a kid, for whatever reason, I don't know if you, I know you're going to remember this name, but it was Billy Casper. He was a guy. I was like, for some reason, I loved his name. I like Billy Casper, man. That's a cool name. And at the time, he played well And as a kid, I watched with my dad, you know, Billy Casper play. So I would say those four would be, you know, I gave you five, actually.
It's okay. That's
to be all right. So it'd have to be.
That's all right. I think Augusta National would let you slide on that particular one. Yeah, I think Billy Casper, Tim, maybe the least heralded of the great players. Billy Casper was one of the all-time great putters. He just happened to play at a time where Mr. Palmer, Mr. Nicklaus, and Mr. Player were at the apex of their careers, and that was tough to compete with those, the big three at that time.
Maybe that's why I was pulling for him. I was pulling for the underdog.
All right, pulling for now. I know you're pulling for the Mets, but kind of give me a crystal ball here. What do you think when the World Series is played? Give me your winner from the American League, and give me your representative from the National League, and give me your champion from those two teams.
It's gonna be a tough one, man. I'm gonna go way underdogs on this. Okay, I'm going for the Magic. The Magic would be the Tigers.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that would be the Magic, and the other Magic would be the Mets.
Sure.
Okay, those would be the two that would team up. So I'm going to stick with that because they haven't proven to me that they're going to lose yet, the Mets. They've had a couple scenarios where they should have lost and they didn't. So I'm going to stay with that as a Magic. Not because I played for them, because short series, I'm going to go on the Nationals bandwagon on when they won it. They were magical. Things were just happening at the right time. And it continued all the way through the series. We had a magic time in 2015 when Daniel Murphy got hot and brought us all the way to the World Series. So
yeah, that's right.
Those are times where you see stuff like this happen and you go, okay, who's going to stop that train? Who's going to stop that train? And so I'm going to go with those two, and then the winner is going to be the Mets. So I'm sticking with my team.
I as well you should. Hey, actually, one final thing. I know you went up to back to city this year for the Hall of Fame or the retirement jerseys for Doc Gooden and for Daryl Strawberry. What was that like? It sounds like that was a pretty cool experience seeing the old guys again, right?
It's great. It's always great to see them. That particular event was awesome for Doc. You know, Doc has struggled through life, and this was a moment where he got to enjoy the praises of the people in the stands, and they really stuck by them. And he even said that in his speech, that you guys have stuck by me through thick and thin. And Straw obviously turned his life around in a big, big way. He's a preacher now and sharing the good news of his Savior. So he's got off that train of drug addiction and all of that, and has told the people about it. So it was great seeing them again. I'm actually going up this next weekend. We're having a big show up in New Jersey. So I'll get to see a lot of the guys again this week, and should be a lot of fun.
Well, it's been a lot of fun having you. And I'll tell you, if your prediction comes true on the 2024 Mets, you're going to have a lot of Mets fans from the 86 team, from all sorts of years. It's going to be another amazing run. Tim Tuffle, this has been so much fun. I'll see you back on the golf course at East Point whenever it stops raining here in Florida. Stay safe and stay dry, my friend.
All right, Kelly. I look forward to it.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
Well, it's great to have Tim Tuffle. We really enjoyed his input, and we'll see if his prediction comes true for his beloved New York Mets. For my good buddy Bob Bupka, Kelly Elvin signing off. Join us next week for another surprise guest here on Musings on Golf. Get out and play. Enjoy the fall season. See you next week.